Hello, everyone. I almost clicked the wrong button.
Oh, no.
We would have cut to a shot of nobody. Hope everybody's doing well. My name is Caleb, and this is my friend Nick. Nick, hey. How you doing?
I'm doing really well. I noticed you didn't introduce our other friend and other co-host here, Zach.
That would be strange because he is not here with us today. It's just Nick and I. Sorry, Zach had some business he had to take care of today, so we'll be holding down the fort. We've got a couple fun topics that we're going to be talking about today. Oh, yeah. We're getting in the weeds a little bit on some more complex stuff. We're going to be talking about copyright law. Thanks to Disney finally losing their eternal war with holding on to their intellectual properties forever. We're also going to be talking a little bit about networking. We're going to talk a little bit about cybersecurity with our friend Mike Soroka and why you might be putting your congregation's information and data at risk if you're not being careful. So don't want to do that. Generally speaking, that's bad vibes for everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Nick, how's your day going? How are you feeling?
Doing pretty good. Good. We had a project through Black Bar Productions that we just posted, a project that we've been working on for a long time that I know that you had a lot to do with. There was a book that just was released yesterday through one of our clients that works with us.
And did it just come out yesterday? Did
it? I believe it was. Yep. 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 Because I just posted about it on their social media that it's now available online. That's good.
Well, once we get this book, we'll have to show it off. I'm pretty happy with the
it is
one. It's worth talking about.
So dang good, man. It's just, it turned out real nice.
Yeah. So. Pretty happy with it. So why don't we get into our first topic of the day today, where to my understanding, Nick, mm-hmm. I can just post any sort of thing I want that Disney's ever made now, and I can do it legally and free.
So there are certain parts of that sentence that are true and certain parts of that sentence that are not. Legally and free and anything that Disney has made, all that, that's not true. So,
okay.
Yeah. What you're referring to, though, is the fact that Disney, the copyright ran out for Disney's Steamboat Willie, which is a version of Mickey Mouse that was from, like, I think the 1920s, maybe. I'm trying to pull. It's probably on the article in front of me, but it's either 1920s, 1940s, somewhere in there. And
which
if you're,
it's not any version of Mickey Mouse. It's just one particular version of Mickey Mouse.
It's this one specific version. One. Mm-hmm. And if you try any other version thinking that you're going to get away with it, you're probably going to get a cease and desist letter. I would even go as far to say that Disney might, I mean, depends on your opinion of Disney, but Disney might just send out some cease and desist for anything that looks like it has a little bit of gray area.
You don't mess with the mouse. There's a couple of companies that are just not worth it. And Disney is certainly one of them.
Yeah, no, like, it's only the specific version of Mickey Mouse, the Steamboat Willie, and you can get a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I've seen people have certainly been taking advantage of this. I've seen scrolling through TikTok and YouTube and whatever else, plenty of Steamboat Willie merch now, whether that be shirts or coffee mugs or whatever, usually doing things that Disney may not necessarily appreciate, just sort of going wild with the fact that if you don't know, Disney has been a huge force in the copyright world of sort of extending the length of making sure that they can hold on to their intellectual properties for as long as humanly possible. Some people like that. Some people don't like that. The goods and bad sides to all that, but they can't hold on to it forever, and they lost this one. And we thought it was sort of worth bringing up because copyright law in general is something that is often misunderstood in many areas of ministry. Many areas.
Ooh, are we getting a guest appearance?
Apparently. especially in the church world, it is incredibly misunderstood. So we wanted to talk about that a little bit today.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think about, like, even, you know, when you think about music, right? The music that we play in churches, if you're not aware There are legal ramifications for not reporting what songs you're using. I'm not a worship leader, and so my knowledge in this area is fairly limited, but that's something I do know, is that by playing certain songs, you have to report, because those rights, the rights to play that music, does not belong to you. And certain packages of how you play the music can depend on if you are able to get the rights to it.
Right. Right. There are, so we wanted to talk specifically because generally speaking, I'm not going to say this is mm-hmm. everybody, but generally speaking, mm-hmm. churches have a relatively cavalier attitude when it comes mm-hmm. to copyright law, right? And we've seen other churches get away with posting, you know, either whether it be giant clips of movies or playing whatever song they want mm-hmm. in the background of a video, or, you know, yada, yada, yada. And certainly there are
streaming laws specific- the Super Bowl.
Streaming
this is Super certainly Bowl. Not
right
allowed.
there are CCLI is an easy mm-hmm. way of handling things within the Christian world, and most yeah. churches already bought into that kind of, but kind of outside of the Christian world, it gets more complicated. So we wanted to talk a little bit about why you should care about this kind of stuff as a church, and how you can protect yourself. And I didn't have the time to make it, but I wanted to put a giant flashing thing on the screen today that says, "We're not lawyers. This is not legal yes. advice. Go talk to your lawyer."
You beat me to it, Caleb. I was going to be like, "Hey, just we're not. This is not legal advice."
Right. Yeah. But it's something you should be aware of. I think something that usually, and especially for small churches, that they sort of take advantage of the fact that obviously they're a small church. Like if they use something from Disney or whatever, like what are they going to care? And chances are, yeah, likely they're not going to find it, let alone come and litigate. However, something to keep in mind, even for the smallest of churches, when you break IP law and everything, or if I own, let's say, like Black Bar, you know, we technically own the intellectual right. property of Black Bar, right? And then somebody starts using the name of Black Bar, and it's a super small, and it's an unrelated thing or whatever, and they use our logo and whatnot, and we decide not to like press charges or not to sort of chase that. And then years later, there's another church media marketing agency that shows up, and they use our name and our logo and our likeness or whatever to start marketing themselves. And we chase them in this very strange hypothetical alternate dimension where this is happening. In the court proceedings, the defense on their side can bring up the fact that we were not consistently applying our like copyright ownership and defense of our own copyright across every area in which we showed up that we were made aware of. They can say, because you were not pursuing at them and you're pursuing on us, you're being especially sort of vindictive on this sort of case, and they can use that defense. So that means that large corporations who have the legal budget to chase people, Disney obviously being one of them, will absolutely, just to make sure that they have sort of the baseline to be able to chase and take down the big people who are like making money off of their IP or whatever, they absolutely will just hunt down people who are using their intellectual property unfairly. So you absolutely should care about it, whether you're a big church, small church, especially if you're using like widely known big intellectual property from organizations, companies that tend to be a little bit litigious.
Sure. And, you know, I know like churches tend to be, I think I'll use the word scrappy. Like, you know, sometimes we make stuff happen out of very little things, right? Like we don't always have the budget or the capacity of larger organizations. And so we kind of, we make do with what we have, but there's another element to this of like, you know, if we are trying to be a light in the darkness, right? There's certainly an argument to be made about trying to do things the right way, trying to do things the legal way,
not just what you can get away with.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh yeah. You know, and, but on that note, Caleb, I think, we had talked earlier too, that there are certain things that nonprofits do have, a little bit of, gray area they can operate in.
Yes. And I know even Corden mentioned in the comments here that, so technically speaking, churches are given the right to have a Super Bowl party, but the word Super Bowl specifically is copyrighted and you're not allowed to promote it as a Super Bowl party. There are also rules specifically around even showing like movies and whatnot. You can get permission to show a movie, and there's a big list. I forget where this list is available.
It's on the CCLI website.
Sure. I remember being back working in the marketing department at University of Valley Forge, and we would have movie nights for the college. And I remember one time we were showing The Dark Knight, some Batman movie, and we had to advertise the fact that we were having a movie night. And we wanted to tell people what the movie was, but we legally could not. So I remember saying, hey, it's movie night. And then there were like bats. On the slide for some reason, right? Yeah. And like, we could hint at it, but we could not explicitly say what the movie was. So there are some interesting rules around that specifically. But I think even past the sort of like giant IPs and whatnot, Disney, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. There's something to be said, even as like a graphic designer or video animator, whatever, and you're going out and looking for resources online and you're going on Google, scrolling through Google Images, and you're just finding something you like to throw on your pastor slide to use at the background for something. If you're not careful about that, that can also be breaking copyright law. Are you less likely to get prosecuted for that kind of stuff? Obviously, absolutely. Sure. But I do think, just like you were saying earlier, Nick, like if there's anybody that should be having like a relatively moral like stance on this kind of thing and doing things right and properly and not stealing the intellectual property from other creators more than likely in the field, I feel like church creatives should kind of be on that bad way. I feel like the attitude of what can we get away with should probably not be the direction that most of us are leaning. At least I would hope.
Yeah. Yeah. We also have a question from Gareth. I don't know if you want to take this question now or leave it for the blackout segment later. But he mentioned, like, how can you play Christian music on a YouTube video on your live stream?
Maybe that is a question.
So yeah, for blackout. End,
As you ask questions today, we will have a section at the very end of the podcast that we're calling Blackout that we started last week or last podcast. And we'll be answering all of those questions there because that is a bit of a larger question, especially if you get outside of the world of there's CCLI and then there's stuff past that. I'm not going to go any further, but stick around. We will answer that question. The other big part that I wanted to talk about today is the general legal doctrine of fair use, because that is sort of when we get into churches actually using intellectual property owned by other companies, this is the conversation that's going to come up. And this conversation comes up all the time on like social media in the world of YouTube, in content creation in general, of when is it actually legal to use somebody else's copyrighted material? Because there are actually rules for this, and you can get away with doing it. I would say, generally speaking, the safest route, don't. That's the safe, like if you want to be the most protected and never have to worry about it, don't do it. But there are legal and safe ways to do it. The problem is the line is not sharp. It's very gray and it's very like up to argument. And chances are you don't want to be spending tithe money on legally defending yourself. But I want to talk over the four things because it does allow us to use IP in sort of creative, interesting ways for sermon illustrations or storytelling or whatever. And fair use, which is the doctrine of how the legal system allows companies to decide or allows companies to use intellectual property owned by other people. There are four sort of like standards, the four factors, I believe they're called, at which it's sort of decided whether or not your use of that IP was fair or not. And the four are the purpose and character of the use, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount and substantiality of the portion taken, and the effect and use on the potential market for the value of the copyrighted work. That's the legal
term. That sounds complicated.
Yeah, it is. Just going through it one by one and keeping it simple. These are litmus tests you could use to see if you are like being safe with the work that you do decide to use. Number one is the purpose and character of the use. And this is specifically talking about the original use case. So we could use Mickey Mouse as an example.
Sure. I think this is a good way. Yeah.
Right. Mickey Mouse was intended originally, he was sort of a creative character brought up for commercial purposes for the most part, right? It was a character brought up to put on TV, right? Probably TV at the time, you know, and to, or was it just movies? It might have been.
It probably was just movies at that point. If we're talking the 30s, yeah.
Right. To make money, right? Mm-hmm. Would be opposed to something like creating a textbook for the purpose of education, right? Versus something that was more just creative, inspired or whatever. And the law has sort of like different amount of leniency or standards for different types of things. So like, for example, if we were doing our educational podcast here and we just pull up a giant textbook about, you know, video production, and I hold it up to the screen and read it word for word, that would probably not fall under the umbrella of fair use. Because I'm literally just taking the entire thing that is built for education and using it for education, but for free. And without permission, that would not be appropriate. As well as in the same way, if Mickey Mouse, who is built to be a commercial product, if I then take Mickey Mouse's likeness, put it on t-shirt and start selling it for a commercial sort of industry or whatever, that would also not be incredibly appropriate. However, if I'm using Mickey Mouse to talk about something that's more educational, right, where it's not necessarily the same use case across both fronts, now there's more of a conversation. I'm not saying it's now all of a sudden, you know, whitelist, you're good, you can do whatever you want.
Sure.
But there, you now lean in the direction of being maybe a bit more fair use. I'll also mention in general, again, this is not a black and white thing, but in general, specifically, nonprofits get more leniency in this regard to using IP material than for-profit companies. So we do have a small leg up if you're a church doing this sort of thing, which is something I didn't know. I found that out when I was researching that this week.
So that's awesome.
Interesting. The next bit is the nature of the copyrighted work. This is now talking a bit more about whether this is sort of the creative. Sorry, I've actually mixed up these two a little bit. The very first one was the purpose and character of the of how we're using it. The second one is the nature of the copyright, how it was sort of intended to be used. So all the points that I've made, I was kind of crossing back and forth between these two. A little bit, my apologies. It's also worth noting that generally creative works are more protected. So movies, we're talking about music, we're talking about art. The original artist usually has a bit more protection in this sort of scope, which unfortunately tends to be more of what churches want to be using, is things that I would generally fall under the category of creative.
That makes sense. Yeah.
the third topic, or the third pillar, is the amount and substantiality of the portion taken. I'm sure we've all been to a sermon before in which they're playing a 30-second clip of some movie, probably Facing the Giants. If you grew
up, I don't know why, but that's where my mind went to.
Right. Yeah, right. I need 10 more.
That's exactly the clip I was thinking.
Right. Oh my gosh. We've all been to a sermon where we've heard that, and then the altar calls right after. The keyboard player snuck up during that and immediately afterwards. If they're really talented, they started hitting a chord that was in the same key as the inspirational music that was playing after, right? And then they started ripping right after that. And generally speaking, you know, 30 seconds of a clip over the course of a 45-minute sermon, the amount of IP material in that is relatively small. However, if you were to play the entirety of Facing the Giants and then preached about it for 3 minutes, now the overwhelming majority of that new piece or content or whatever that you made is majority IP material that was not transformative. It wasn't anything that you change or edited. And that is not going to be great. That's not going to look good. So generally, if you're going to be using intellectual property, be using the most minimal amount of it as you can to make your point, whatever that might be. And then the sort of last pillar to be talking about is the effect of the use on the potential market for the value of the copyrighted work. So if you were to, we could use Mickey Mouse as an example again, and sure. I'm going to make a bunch of Disney Mickey Mouse merch and put Mickey Mouse on t-shirts or whatever, and I'm selling it on Amazon and yada, yada, yada. And I'm selling it for a relatively inexpensive price and a bunch of people are buying it. Now, a bunch of people who were fans of Disney and were fans of Mickey Mouse bought my product instead of buying Disney's product. And I very directly affected the value of the market for that original product. And Disney would sue my pants off for doing that kind of thing. So if you are,
all the money that you
sold. All that and more, and probably damages and whatnot. So, I mean, if you're doing like just showing a clip of a movie or something in your sermon, generally speaking, I don't think that's going to be affecting the value of the original IP or anything. But there's certainly, like, arguments have been made about, like, even people doing, like, clips and synopses on YouTube and saying, like, okay, now I don't need to watch the entire movie. You explained it to me.
React channel, stuff like that.
Yeah. Don't start a church React channel. That's React channels are cringe anyway. And then a more general thing to be thinking about is a word that comes up a lot in this sort of space is transformative, and then parody comes on top of this as well. So when we talk about something that is transformative is I'm taking sort of intellectual property work or whatever, and I'm adjusting it and I'm changing it and I'm making something new out of it. This isn't just taking Mickey Mouse's likeness and putting it on a t-shirt. It's taking things about Mickey Mouse and the character, whatever, and then making my own character that maybe looks kind of like it, but it's not quite like it. And it's all pixels that I made. It's all work that I did. And even though it has some amount of relation to it, I generally can be protected. Making something new and transformative and different and whatever out of the thing. And then along that same lines, parody is extremely protected in the United States specifically. So I remember even a number of years ago, back when we were both working at Grand Rapids First, we had a Christmas series that we did that was 100% just a parody of Hallmark. Hallmark in its entirety. We had fancy greeting cards that we're using as invites for everybody. Our staff made funny, stupid, like Hallmark
The Hallmark
parodies. Yeah. It was ridiculous. But the whole thing was called Hallelujah, and it all had this very much tongue-in-cheek Christian spin to it. And I managed to find literally like close to the exact font as the Hallmark logo, it was saying Hallelujah instead. And we were being very intentionally tongue-in-cheek, funny parody with it. Everybody knew we were referencing Hallmark. Nobody thought that it was a Hallmark event, that this was actually Hallmark's product, right? We were making a joke of it. And that is really, when you're talking about parody and sort of modifying, changing things on that end, as if you could think about the litmus test is, could anybody be convinced that this is actually from the thing that you're parodying? Then you have not done enough to transform the work. So generally speaking, if you follow those guidelines, if you're transformative or use parody, if you are using the original copyrighted work for not the original purpose that it was sort of intended to be used for, if you're using the minimal amount as possible that you need to sort of get across your point, and the whatever it is that you're making or doing with that does not affect the value of the original work, you should be okay-ish. But if you want to be safe, don't touch it.
Yep, just don't touch it. And we're not, this isn't illegal advice. We're not lawyers. But you're, yeah, Caleb, you're right. I think a lot of that transformative stuff, like, I think that's where a lot of people get into trouble, is it just doesn't, it's not transformative enough when they do something. I even think of, and this will make you roll your eyes, but you remember in the early 2000s when they had like the, instead of Intel Inside, it was Jesus Inside t-shirts that they made, that whole line of like, just take a logo and try to make it Christian.
Yes. I will specifically call out my beloved, whom I love to death, cousin Aaron, you know who you are, that literally his entire wardrobe for all of middle school and high school was exclusively like, it's the Heinz logo, right?
Yeah. But
it says Jesus or Sprite or whatever. And it says Savior.
It's like Spirit.
Literally it was his whole thing. The whole, oh, like, man. For all four or five, I'm not sure how we didn't get bullied into the earth. With kind of, if that's your form of evangelism, great. It's certainly
it's a conversation starter, Caleb.
Yeah, but those, obviously, I mean, I'm sure you could still buy those things. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you should, it's a different conversation. But those are very much thoroughly falling under the category of parody, right? Mm. Nobody thinks that that is a shirt designed by Heinz or designed by Sprite. We're just sort of taking a culturally relevant thing and making like a really poor excuse for a sermon with it instead. So... my opinions
clearly.
Have you done any questionable things in the world of copyright, Nick, that you'd like to confess to the world?
I'm checking our chat. I'm like, was that a question someone asked?
No, I'm just curious. I'm just curious if you have.
I don't think so. I know of a case of someone I know that may have accidentally done something about that, but. It wasn't me.
Permission to talk about it. So yeah, I remember being very young. Probably in mid high school at the time, and the church that I was attending at the time asked me to create something for their Christmas service, and I used the entirety of the Trans-Siberian Orchestra "Carol of the Bells" because. You know, that was the vibe at the time, and clips from, I think, The Passion and everything to create the most ridiculous video compilation I possibly could have. Sure. And all I can think about now is like, that thing was the definition of not fair use. I didn't get permission for anything. I was just shooting from the hip and making something I thought was cool. One of the worst things I've ever created, no question. And it has been burned from the internet and you'll never find it. But you know, it's everybody makes stupid mistakes early on. Unfortunately, I just had a platform to throw it on.
At the time, sure.
Which, you know.
Yeah. Now you're talking about that. I don't think it was me, but I do recall there being a lot of opportunities where people wanted media. And like the go-to thing was to find some version of clips from The Passion of the Christ, and you would always throw that into like I remember watching YouTube videos where people would take someone else's music and then throw clips from The Passion behind it, and then they'd upload it to YouTube and be like, hey guys, check out this thing I made. So it's kind of like two things there where you're taking someone else's music, someone else's video, and presenting it as your own.
Right.
And certainly that possibly could have lived in one of those gray areas, but I would not want to try to navigate that now.
It is Passion of the Christ on CCLI?
It probably is. I bet you. Probably. I would be really surprised if it wasn't. It's probably one of the few R-rated movies that is. but
interesting.
We got a comment that's probably worth talking about here. Johnny Yepes in our comments mentioned about one of the sermon series they did at his church called Wisdom for Dummies, which if I remember and if I remember, I think Johnny made this really great animation for it, which turned out really cool because they used like the logo has like usually like a character, some sort of like stick figure character. Well, they took that character and transformed it into an image of their lead pastor.
There you go.
And so perhaps that's where the transformative portion was in there.
Sure.
But Johnny,
it's
Johnny
definitely, you know, it's close. And it's all gray area. It's all, all the whole conversation of fair use is it's not black and white. It does need to be argued. And which is why, generally speaking, it's better to play it safe. Mm-hmm. Just make your own material, you know. But, you know, there is a time and a place for it if you're doing it right, if you are being careful. So we just wanted to talk about it. Again, we're not legal experts. This is not legal advice. But a general 10,000 foot view. Hopefully you're a little bit more educated understanding on this world than you were previously.
Nice. Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully.
Wanted to get into our second topic today. It's very different from that, but also extremely in the weeds and also pre-recorded. So we brought on our good friend, Mike Soroka, on last night, actually, to talk specifically about the world of cybersecurity, about the world of networking and everything. And if this is not something that you've touched before or had to think about before, you should be thinking about before. Mike does a really great job of helping you understand why this is important, not just for the IT professionals at your church, because most churches don't have IT professionals, but you as a pastor and even you as a creative, why your wireless NDI or your wireless lights or literally anything you have in the network is not safe unless you're careful about it.
That was one of the biggest takeaways from this conversation, was just the fact of how vulnerable things like that can be. And it's not something that was just like, was clear, you know, like, oh, of course this could be vulnerable, but we'll let Mike talk more about it.
Yeah. We'll see you back in a little while. Enjoy old us.
Hello, everyone. We're here from the past and Zach looks a lot different. Sorry about that.
this is a good friend, Mike Soroka. In the world of networking and cybersecurity, you're the guy, is what I've been told. My friends have all told me you're the guy. Is that correct?
Depends. Yeah. Yeah.
You're amongst the guys, at least.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And you've been doing this for a minute.
Probably about 5 years. 5 years or so.
Yeah. Wonderful.
But before that, obviously, I was a tinkerer, and you know, and did things that, you know, could get you a little trouble or whatever. So
I'm seeing a box in the background that has that might get some people in trouble if they are not as
if they don't know what they're doing, right?
The laws. Right. Yep. For sure. I think we'll talk about a couple other toys like that a little bit later.
Oh boy.
So you and I have been talking a lot recently because the Black Bar has sort of a server setup it's a home server for the most part, but we host a lot of our files on there and storage for clients that we work with. You can call us up at BLKWAR. And I was managing it very much as an amateur, and I had a question about my router, and I texted you my question, and you were very gracefully able to inform me that I was doing a lot of things very incorrectly, and exposing my public IP and all of the ports that I had open to the whole world, not just to my server, but to theoretically my entire home network. And you were able to help me understand an affordable option with Ubiquiti, which I'm a big fan of Ubiquiti now, to be able to solve that. And I very much appreciate that. But we got to talking afterwards about the fact that, you know, I'm relatively speaking a tech savvy guy, and there's a lot of people working in churches, a lot of churches who don't have hugely tech savvy guys, and even some that don't, and are dealing with hundreds of people, potentially thousands, some even tens of thousands of people walking in every single week. And there are arguably things that churches should be aware of in the world of cybersecurity that I don't think most churches have a person that's focused on that kind of thing. I think in the same world as like media production or communications or even a tech guy, I know you've served as a tech guy as well at a church, that's usually like the youngest guy in the room that has proven that they know how to work like PowerPoint, right? And this also can fall into those categories, especially at smaller churches. So I think what I would love to talk to you about today, sort of starting off, is cybersecurity can sound, and networking in general, can sound really, really boring. Why on earth should anybody care about it? Tell us some horror stories on why people should care about this world.
So the biggest thing is a lot of people don't realize how many people are actually on the internet, like at any given moment. I just looked up, I saw an article, it was from this month of this year, just saying that currently there's 5.35 billion people that are like connected to the internet at all times.
Most of the world, I think.
66%, it says, yeah.
That number sounds so familiar to when we did the population of China, talking about like nations online and stuff. That's a lot. That's an entire nation of people.
Well, that's most of the nations of people.
Yeah. Yeah, and of that, over 5 billion of them are actually on social media. So I feel like that alone, you know, churches are reaching people on social media now. You know, that's like where people are at, and that's where they try to you know, get the word out. With that said, you're on the internet. There's people out there that want to get your data, do things that aren't good, you know, like with churches, you know, with them streaming, with you know, all of these things are how we manage our finances, how we you know, we send out e-blasts, we again, social media, you know, creative side, people, you know, using Adobe products, a lot of that stuff is cloud-based, and all that stuff is on the internet. And we access it every single day. Churches access it every single day. And there's, you know, do you leave your house and make sure you lock the door when you leave? Do you lock your, you know, the door, you know, your car when you leave and in a parking lot? It's the same thing as you know, these accounts and whatnot. Is the reason why you lock it is to keep the bad guy out. So,
right, sure. So. To my understanding, most of your experience in the world of cybersecurity is specifically Team Blue, which is defensive side. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes. Yep. Yep. Right. A lot of the stuff that I actually...
Yeah, there's
there's Team different Red. Teams.
There are Mike, you tell me if I'm wrong, but Team Blue is keeping people out of the house, and Team Red is sort of a white hat hacker of like you're hiring someone to see if they can break in. And exploit whatever white problems hat that you have. Term.
I've heard that before.
Right? Am I correct in those definitions, Mike?
Yeah, and they have tournaments of capture the flag. And
right.
Yeah. Yep. What?
So okay. So why? Like, I know obviously you've been on Team Blue, which is great. Thank you for being on Team Blue. but if I was like a Team Red, or maybe like a malicious Team Red sort of deal, why would? Like, if I'm thinking of a place to hack into, churches typically, I would think, would not be near the top of the list. Why would a church necessarily be a target for someone who is interested in getting a hold of juicy data? What data could they have?
Yes, big corporations and stuff are usually the target, right? Governments. But they are sending out... whether it's a phishing email or whatever, they're sending out stuff all the time and just waiting for someone to bite. Right. So that's happening all the time, just all the time. And churches, if you really think about it, how much cash flow goes through churches? It's quite a bit. And you know, people would donate and tithe, in checks and cash. Well, how many churches now are doing that digitally? Because that's just how
post 2020, right? most everyone has some sort of online giving program.
Yeah, financial stuff is usually the biggest thing that they want. They want money. Mm-hmm. So if if you're a decent sized church, you could easily be targeted to be hacked in certain ways. Whether it's ransomware or just trying to get the account data, trying to get information on the congregation.
Mike, you used a term there, ransomware. What is ransomware?
That is when they get access to your data and they encrypt it. The only way to get that data back is to have the keys to the encryption, and they want to you to pay for it.
So what you're telling me is it sounds like the someone who's hacking might grab like access to your like your website and all the information on your website, right? And they're basically holding them ransom. I guess that's why it's called ransomware.
Sure.
Yeah.
I would imagine the website might be the least of your worries of what they could. I know, Mike, you and I were talking before about like these church management softwares like Breeze, Fellowship One. I think even Planning Center has their own version of it now, where these churches, they have names. They have addresses often, the ages of the entire family, like all of that data. So it's not just the church or the church staff or the church resources. It is the members of your congregation's information and data that you have on your own systems, even if you're using a CMS or whatever, that it's not going to take too much. And like usually we think of hackers, right, as like black screen, green text, just typing a bunch of code and blowing up your mainframe or whatever. But most of the time it's an admin getting tricked into typing their username and password or something that is absolutely not the site that they thought it was. Or, you know, someone just walking in, having a conversation, social engineering a code out of someone or whatever, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And then especially how many churches are using like Office products, you know, Office 365. That's a lot of times where they're storing their files from their office and where they're using for sending emails. That alone puts them in the same spot as any type of business.
And I know also, we also had a brief conversation before about, because I know we have obviously a bunch of creatives listening, especially on the tech side, that there's a lot of technology in the production world, whether that be like wireless video protocol or lighting or whatever, that if you're not careful about how you set up your network, is theoretically just open to anybody who goes looking for it, who connects to your Wi-Fi. Am I right?
Yeah. If you don't have proper segmentation on your network, where that's pretty much you're identifying traffic and you're making sure that it can, you know, one device on it can't talk to the other. They don't put money into these management ports, you know, for logging in to your PA system, you know, to adjust EQs and crossovers and whatnot. They're not looking at it that way. They're looking at a convenience way of being able to get in there and you know, adjust your system or adjust the frequencies on your wireless miking system. They have a username and password, right? But they don't have any more than that. And usually most places are going to leave it at the default username and password.
Sure. Yep.
And there's master lists. People don't realize that you can just Google and it will tell you the factory username and password of like millions and millions of companies and devices. So,
what you're saying, it sounds like if something's on a Wi-Fi network, it sounds like it's pretty vulnerable. Could be very vulnerable to these attacks
if not properly set up. Yep.
So let me get this straight. I think I heard you say like lighting and stuff. So like I know some churches will use their, you know, do video over NDI, right? If saying what you're saying, not properly set up, let's say factory default, someone's using NDI to run video, is it possible someone could like hack into that and send their own rogue signal through NDI?
Yep.
That's not good. That's awful.
That's not good at all.
I'm thinking of, what was it, the Max Headroom thing that happened where they hacked into that TV station and they had that whole, whole thing.
Yeah, so you could basically, that at your church.
I mean, that's not great.
That wouldn't be great. And the tools for I know this of my own hobbyist looking into this sort of world, and I know we alluded to a couple devices earlier. The tools for causing problems in this sort of the world
are getting more and more accessible and more inexpensive. Yep. Even like, so I know I mentioned the little box sitting behind you right there, called a Wi-Fi pineapple. I mean, you can buy that. I think it's like $150, something like that. And that's sort of an all-in-one Wi-Fi hacking tool. I was able to, with the one that I have set up here, I was able to pick up Wi-Fi networks and like properly identify them and access them from nearly like a little over a quarter mile away, I would say. Like it, the antennas on that, and then to be able to scrape traffic off of that. So even if you don't know what sort of is open or available, you can just set up and listen and just hear what is happening on a Wi-Fi network.
Yep. And okay,
who knows?
That raises another question for me, and Mike, maybe you can help answer this. That seems to give you an amount of control and access that is a little terrifying with what you call it, the pineapple. Okay, so how does this lead?
So a lot of the tools that are used maliciously are tools that are original was for monitoring. And for like in a utility standpoint, which is why usually people that are doing network security, they have to learn how a hacker does things. So in essence, that's where you get the one team and the other team is that they know the same thing because they're trying to prevent each other. One's supposed to trying to get in, one's trying to prevent that person from getting in. And that's where a lot of those tools are designed, and they go both ways.
Right. I think my very favorite example and my favorite personal toy in the space is this wonderful little device. It was making headlines just about everywhere about a year ago.
Yeah, it kind of went viral. Yeah,
it certainly did. And that's what I bought mine, to be honest. I saw some stupid high schooler turn off his projector in the middle of class. Like, oh, I got to have that, whatever that is. But it's called a Flipper Zero. And it's just sort of like an all-in-one hacking tool. And it's got a bunch of stuff that you could do Wi-Fi hacking in here. It's got bad USB in here. It's got like sub gigahertz stuff. It can do RFID. It can do a bunch of different things. And even with just this tool and a little bit of Googling around, I was able to edit a script that would run anytime that I plugged this into a computer. It's got a little USB dongle. And I ran it on my dad. And I told him I ran it on him afterwards. I'm not doing anything too bad. But like I plugged it into his computer and I ran the script, and it took about 15 seconds to run. It didn't require any touch. It essentially emulates a keyboard and then just starts typing code as fast as the computer can handle it. And I was able to scrape every single saved password that he had on Chrome, Firefox, Safari, Microsoft Edge, and I think it was Opera. And it would grab all that, save that into a little zip file, and then upload it to a remote server. And then I unplug it, and there's no evidence that I was ever there, right? And it was just that fast. And this little thing you could get for like $150, $160. There are bad USBs that are way cheaper than that. I know we talked about that a little bit beforehand.
Yeah.
This does a bunch of stuff. This is a multi-tool. You could build a bad USB for probably $20, $30 if you know what you're doing. Like, it's so easy to do this stuff now.
Yeah, and especially with a bad USB, right? So you plug it in, you can make it act just like a normal USB. So the person does not know whatsoever, and it runs a script. Which would be like a small, like, you know, software ish, you know, a command, and, it would run, and it would, whatever you ask it to do, if you don't have the proper, things in place, it would then send that data out on that same person's computer, and they're copying pictures or a video or whatever. And it works the same. And what happens is then as soon as they hand it to someone else to be like, hey man, I copied these videos for you. And then they give it to the other person. It's going to do the same thing. And it's how long do you usually hold on to a USB? Probably quite you know, now that they're good. I feel like back in the day when we were slow and everything, you were always waiting for the latest greatest. But now it's like, I have USBs that are like 8 years old, you know, and I'm still using them. But if it was a bad USB, how many people have I shared that with? It's pretty crazy.
Mike, you kind of explained this a little bit, but I'm going to press a little bit farther here. You talked about bad USB. I'm taking that means exactly it's a USB that does bad things.
Yes. So it's the size he's holding up right there. Mm-hmm. It's the size of a USB. They make them look like, I have one right here that actually looks just like a generic. People have probably seen these. Mm-hmm. They have like the little metal hinge, literally nothing, nothing otherwise. But then when you open it up, it actually has a mini computer in there, and you actually put a SD card in there, and it runs whatever script that you put on that SD card.
It's terrifying. It's so like they also make them now. The company that makes, if I believe, the company that makes that also makes them now in the form factor of a iPhone Lightning like cable.
I've heard
so it looks just like a normal iPhone charging cable, and it will do the exact same thing, to my understanding, on either side. It could punch in the script to the phone, or it can do it to the computer. That's
terrifying.
Yeah, especially that same cable. What people don't realize is that same cable that he's talking about can create its own Wi-Fi. So the attacker could this actually happens in the airports all the time. Is that they plug it in, they charge their phone, they plug it in, and that be a mile away because it creates, you know, a connection back over the Wi-Fi to their device, and then they can remotely do it, and no one would know anything other. So
now, Caleb has told me never to have my Wi-Fi on in an airport. I'm taking a guess that's part of the reason.
Yes. I don't trust any of them.
Yeah, and what's nice though is they actually sell these little adapters that you can actually plug onto a USB that it just allows the power, because you know, a USB cable, you know, the new Type C's might have like 20 something pins in it, and every one of them, some of them send data, some of them send video, and then there's like a handful that is just for power, and you can add these little adapters onto it. You know, you can keep it in your purse or whatever, in your pocket or whatever. And you add it to the end, and then it just allows power. And then that way you can guarantee that whether if it was malicious, it's fine.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I think even with something like this, obviously I'm not, maybe it's not obvious. I'm not running around and hacking my neighbors and random people at the mall. Like, that's not something I'm doing, but I can tell you just having this and realizing what is possible with a little consumer $150 device has completely changed the way that I do interact with the online world and the way that I use my devices and what Wi-Fi I'm willing to connect to and what I'm not, and the kind of wallet that I bring. Like, it's just being aware of how easy it is to exploit other people's like lack of security makes me just like all the more careful about like the past, like using password managers and yada yada yada. So we could probably spend 4 hours talking about all the fun stories of ways that we can exploit people's lack of security. I'm curious to make this a like a productive, helpful talk for everybody that might be a little nervous.
Not just scare
right
them.
Right. What are some like easy, practical for people who have never touched, who never thought they're using the same password for everything that they've opened up since they were 13 years old? What are some like super easy first steps that anybody could take, specifically in the church, you know, world, whether it be pastor, creative production, whatever, to protect the church, yourself, you know, the people around you? What are some easy steps people could take?
The biggest one I would say is you need to assess what accounts you have, especially in a church. Obviously, there's multiple roles depending on the size of the church. And knowing what accounts are attached to church accounts.
Sure.
Whether it is in production or in the office for financial, for church management software. Knowing what you have, because you can't lock it down. You can't make sure that it's has, you know, unique passwords that don't relate to anything to the church or the people that are actually using those accounts. You gotta know it first, right? So having that and documenting it is the number one step. And then I would say the next is to have a password manager. Unless I highly don't recommend, most people probably do still to this day, have an Excel document that has all their passwords in it, and it's called passwords.
Passwords. It's on your
and
desktop.
And it's on the desktop or your documents.
Yeah.
And I don't care if you have a password on that Excel document, it can be easily broken very, very quick. Mm-hmm. So yeah, password manager, and adding all on all of those accounts, whatever it, whatever they have for security on it, whether it's like multi-factor or some type of two-step, that is crucial. It's still not perfect, but it's like the best that we have right now. Right. And a lot of company, softwares are going that route. Even ones that I'm you know, kind of shocked that they don't really have any like sensitive information, but it's just that's where the industry is going. Sure. And a lot of people are being pressured by governments and just different type of organizations to go that no matter what. Like that just become the norm. And unfortunately the church doesn't fall under any of that. Them knowing and having the understanding at least of how to go about protecting yourself is I think it's really, really important.
And two-factor authentication, I imagine everybody has at least heard that before. And I know even like logging into Google's like, you should set up two-factor authentication. And no, I need to check my Gmail right now. Thank you. we'll do it another time.
Right.
It literally takes, you know, maybe a minute, if that. And then, you know, every time you're logging in, you just pull up your little authenticator app on your phone or whatever device you set it up on. And it takes an extra 10 seconds. But the amount, not even church related at all, a good friend of mine and a good friend of Nick's, our friend Grant, got his entire Steam library completely stolen from him like 3 years ago. And that thing was worth more than three digits. And the speed at which I set up two-factor authentication immediately afterwards to make sure that never happened to me. You don't want to make that decision after you've lost it. Like now he has it set up, I guarantee you. It's too late at that point. It's already been lost. And that is the wrong time to be making these sort of measures to protect yourself.
Yes. Yes. And it's the same thing with like the ransomware. I'm like, if your creative team has some type of storage where you have all of your church media, whether it's like videos or all the projects that you're working on, if they were to come in and encrypt all of that, unless you're going to pay out, which they never ask for a little bit of money. It's always way more than most people can afford. Then that data is gone. So there's no reversal for that.
I have certainly heard of like large companies who have been hit with ransomware and they just pay because they've really, there's no other option for the most part. It's not.
Yeah, that's actually where I got heavily into this is our company actually a handful of years ago got ransomware and it was the longest 2 to 3 weeks of my life
I believe it
bringing the whole company back up so yeah
good
it
nice.
Was that's where we drastically practices and this is where a lot of this that I'm doing now is from so
sure that makes sense. You lost your Steam library, you're making sure it doesn't happen. Right. So go ahead.
I was just gonna say I'm stitching together some points here. Like it's sounding like if someone does ransomware to a church, right, gets all their data, there's an absurd amount of money that's being held as the ransom. I mean, you either pay that or you lose it, right? And I can imagine like for some people it would be a really really tough pill to swallow, where you have to tell your church a sizable amount of people's giving is now just gone because they had to
to pay.
It's not even that. It's either they like I dumped, you know, 100 grand into getting all of our data back, or it's not just like the hackers are holding on to it. Like, give me the money or I'll never give it back. It's give me the money or I'm going to make all of this public right now. Mm-hmm. And now all of like I'm going to leak it onto the black market or whatever. And now all of a sudden. Yeah. All these people have now free and open access to everyone in your congregation's home addresses and every single one of their names and email address. It's not a good time.
I'm terrified for the pastor who has to stand up in front of a congregation and say, we're having a special giving to pay the ransom. Pay the ransom. Oh, and you need to do it because it's your data.
We are all like, collectively being held ransom right now.
I know, right? Like, I just think it screams the importance of this issue. Like, you know, is not just something you can sleep on. This is something that, Mike, I'm looking forward to some more of your some more advice to steer clear of this, because hopefully our audience can make use of it.
Yeah. And honestly, there is a lot of the things that you can do are free. So it's, you know, obviously size churches and obviously drastically different budgets between each. Sure. Password managers, not all of them, most of them are free. They have free like user account that do 90% of what the person wants, that has multi-factor on the main account, so that way that's locked down. You can do all your passwords in there, and they integrate with a lot of them, integrate with a lot of the different services. So that can be free. The paid ones, honestly, I don't really feel like what you get is worth it. So I always tell people just to go with the free account. Unless you're a huge organization, that's where the features come into play.
Sure.
Biggest thing is what people don't realize is taking administrative rights from a single desktop, whether it's Mac or not. The main account is the full administrative account. You have full access to do anything on that actual computer. Mm-hmm. So if someone does not have full access to it, and someone does on accident stick a bad USB into there, it would prevent majority of what it can do. But that's in case that boils down to if that person is smart and actually does that. That's free.
How can you prevent a bad USB attack? Can we start there?
Put in rogue USB sticks.
Okay.
There's different ways. A lot of, like, if we're talking about corporate, a lot of corporate, they actually turn off the USBs, and people hate it.
Wow.
But most people don't need it. Now, obviously, if you're sharing files, they usually recommend actually sharing files digitally. So if you have like a OneDrive or use what Google's version of Google Docs, they want you to share in that environment, because that way you can say, hey, this person can only have this document that I'm sending. It won't work under anyone else. So that's a way to prevent leakage of data in that sense, and prevent people that shouldn't be having access to it to get access to it. Obviously, if you use a thumb drive and you lose it and you're like, oh my goodness, like anyone, there was financial information on that or whatever. You don't have to worry about that. I'm trying to think of some other things. The admin rights is the biggest thing. Because if you don't have admin rights, you can restrict. And some people think, they're like, oh, if I don't have admin rights, that prevents my daily use on it. No, like you browsing, you doing mail, stuff like that, watching videos, whatever ask is, does not need administrative rights. It's mainly like installing software and running certain commands, which the bad USB would try to fire off. But if you don't have it, it just doesn't work. So
And if you know the username and password to the admin account, whenever those things happen, you could just type them in. It takes an extra second, and you're still secure because you're not logged in with an account that has it by default.
Right, and you even can have it like on Windows. Windows is, you know, updates galore, right? There's updates all the time. if you don't have admin rights, it's still, if you have auto updating on, it still works in the background. You know what I mean? Right. So it's not like you're going to constantly have to use it. People aren't realize they could go 6 months without ever having to
sure.
type in that admin username and password. So if you have something that is trying to keylog, which is, you know, actually trying to, it uses your, what you push on the keyboard and is logging all of that, all those keystrokes. If you're not using your admin username and password, besides maybe a couple times in a year, that limits that if that was happening, the worst thing they could do is get your username and password. So,
right. So I get, just like the first half, I think we could go on and on and on about all the different things. I do want to ask sort of a last thing. If someone is interested in taking more steps in this direction and they, you know, they throw on their password manager and they rip admin rights off of everything and they store it in a metal safe or something, are there resources or directions or things that you'd point them online of, like, they want to learn more about it, they're excited about it, they want to figure it out, where would you point someone, what direction would you point them, of someone who's interested in this world of cybersecurity?
Oh man, there's so many resources.
I know.
Honestly, YouTube is like a huge, huge resource. Because right. what people don't realize is, like, a lot of actual professional, like, companies and organizations that actually do this for a living, they have a presence on there. Like, we use tons and tons of Cisco products for security and our networking and our, you know, wireless, all of that. They have so much resources on YouTube. All their videos and everything are all through there. One of the biggest things I would say is there is a government agency called CISA. It's an acronym for, like, Cybersecurity Institution of something of America. CISA.gov. Okay. And
nice.
They in real time publish all vulnerabilities that they are aware of on products, and they also have like just general practice, you know, good hygiene on security and stuff. They have it's a great source, it's government, so it's I check that all the time. I actually have a RSS feed that actually sends me information if there's any new exploits or potential things that are happening around. So,
yeah, that's super cool. Like with most things in the world, the tech world, at least, YouTube seems to reign supreme of learning.
YouTube and Google are most IT people's friends. So,
yes, most definitely. Cool. Well, Mike, thank you so much. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, Mike, you've convinced me. I'm gonna have to, immediately after this conversation, I'm gonna be updating all my passwords and making sure two-factor is turned on. It should be.
I've been getting on you about passwords for a while, so I'm glad that we're finally here. Mike, thank you very much for coming on and talking about this. This probably won't be the last time. Next time there's a huge, big security blow up at a church, we're gonna have you on, just talk about everything they did wrong. Just so everybody can learn.
There you go.
Their mistakes. Mike, appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
You know, like, that whole conversation, I'm so glad it was yesterday, because I've already done so much between then and now to try to cover up some of the holes in my own cybersecurity.
I was going to ask you if you actually did go and take the advice and start making changes. It sounds like you have. Yeah.
Yes, indeed I have, actually. We've been talking about, I know the comments were talking about different types of password managers and stuff like that. You know, it's just such a real thing, you know, like the problem is real, right? It's something that could really affect anyone. And I remember, even as far back as like 2016, I was listening to a podcast where they talked about a woman who had a ransomware on her computer, and she ended up having to, like, find a Bitcoin ATM, which is not as rare as it used to be, but like that was the only type of currency the hackers would accept. And she kept going back and forth because the bit rate, the exchange rate for Bitcoin.
That's funny. The bit
changed.
Rate. Yeah. Sure. It's definitely absolutely something to be careful of. Obviously if you're a church, but even just personal, having a good like digital hygiene on that account, like I mentioned yesterday, watching my buddy Grant losing his entire Steam account scared me straight several years ago. And I've been so much more. I used to be like within 4 or 5 years, I was the I have one password for everything guy. And now everything is a completely different password that's all randomly generated. And it's all sitting on a password manager that I'm self-hosting because I don't trust anybody with my stuff anymore. You know, I've got full 180.
Pass, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I was using LastPass for a number of years, and I think it was twice in 1 year they had an amount of data leak out that might have included the passwords. Like, that is the one job that this is the one reason I'm using you is to not leak this. And you've leaked it twice in 1 year. So that's, I got inspired to jump.
It was a paid subscription too, if I recall. So, like,
I was using the paid version.
Yeah. Sure.
It was dumb. So thanks again, Mike, for coming in and talking about this. It's definitely an important topic, not one that I think gets enough coverage, especially in the church media world.
That's it for the audio-only version of this episode of the Black Bar Podcast. If you'd like to be part of the full live podcast, which includes our slightly more casual and often more chaotic Q&A blackout segment, then be sure to join us for our live bi-weekly episodes over on our YouTube channel. Otherwise, you can expect the podcast in this format the Monday following the live broadcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to give us a rating and review on whatever podcast platform you're using so that you can help educate, encourage, and inspire a fellow creative. And finally, if you're ever in need of any support from community to consultation to content creation, visit our website, blk.bar, for a variety of resources. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast, and we'll see you on the next one.